With me is Alan Pitts, W1AGP, and he is the ARRL Media and Public Relations Manager. And in our wired world, I want to say welcome to the wireless.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, you know, you've got an unusual kind of story to tell, and a unique story to tell, but I want to first talk, let folks know a little bit about who you are. You come to the ARRL after a three-year stint as executive director for something called the Box Project.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, the Box Project is a national nonprofit organization that matches families from all over the United States with families that live in some of the worst areas of rural poverty in the U.S., and had the delight of working with them and for them for a number of years, matching up families and helping people get along in areas in Mississippi and parts of Appalachia, and expanding it out into a number of the reservation areas in South Dakota. So that was kind of fun, which was totally different from amateur radio, but at the same time, it got me around the country and helped me to understand and a little more about all the different parts of the country and different ways of looking at things that you'll find as you do a lot of traveling.
Well, you know, the other thing, too, it probably also opened the door for you to see how amateur radio can relate to folks in different parts of the country, especially during disasters and emergencies.
Oh, absolutely. In different parts of the country at that time, we're doing many various different things and different approaches to it, which now with, well, especially after what happened with Katrina, where we had an event which was not just one state or one section, but splattered over five states. With the FEMA coming on in and the various NIMS courses and the other courses and management situations that are being created and developed, everybody's trying to get to sing on the same piece of sheet music here so that we're all using the same language, we're all coming in with the same expectations and be able to work together. And that includes the hams.
Well, in your background, it says that that you were an ARES District Emergency Coordinator. Later, you were Connecticut's Section Emergency Coordinator. And, let's see, an ARRL Assistant Section Manager. You also have a master's degree from Lutheran Theological Southern Seminary. And it says that you actually served in congregations, so you were a minister at one time.
That is correct. Yes, I was a Lutheran pastor for a number of years.
Very, very interesting. And you're active now on amateur radio and the media and public relations manager for the ARRL, which is, I think, very, very good. Well, let me
somehow it's supposed to all go together into one lifestyle, but it doesn't.
Well, actually, I think it does. It sounds to me like it does. You know, it all goes together very well. Let me ask you a question, though. What are some of the milestones that you could talk about briefly that amateur radio and the ARRL was able to achieve during Katrina? I mean, you're more familiar. There's a lot of stories.
Oh, there were several major ones. The biggest thing is the Amateur Radio Emergency Services, or ARES, A-R-E-S, had been arranged primarily on what we'll call a section basis. Now, a section normally is a state. Some of the larger states have more than one section in them. But everything was figured that one state would pretty well be able to handle and organize whatever response might be needed by the amateur radio community. What happened with Katrina was that we had not just one section, Louisiana, or even two, Louisiana, Alabama. We had five states that were hammered. Now, agreed, some of them got worse than others, but there were problems, major problems, in five different states, and of course they don't want to call them refugees, but that's what they were being scattered over even more states. There was no communication. There really wasn't down there, and the amateur radio people are the ones that came in and had to step up to the plate. But the question now is, how do you do that over such a large area, and you're bringing in amateur radio people from other parts of the country to come on in? So well, you may know, okay, these are the protocols, and this is what we agreed upon for Louisiana, or this is what we agreed upon for southern Mississippi, or this is what we agreed upon for Alabama. Well, here comes a guy out in New York, a dang Yankee, comes down, and, you know, he knows New York's protocols and procedures and everything very, very well. Obviously, he would also know amateur radio rules and regulations very well, but how now does he fit in with the emergency response for a town in Louisiana? And that got interesting and was something different. How do we coordinate all this? The ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, headquarters here in Newington, took on a new role that had never been done before. We were trying to coordinate a national-level amateur radio response. And that was something, by pure luck of the draw, our executive Vice President Dave Sumner was over in Europe at the time, and he's trying to get back. But meanwhile, Harold Kramer, Dave Patton, and myself kind of pull things together and then pull in what we call a CAT team for Katrina team of other managers and started a function which was never dreamed of for the ARRL National Headquarters, which was coordinating amateur radio response on a full national level, bringing in people from literally all over the country, funneling them in and getting them to the organizations and the locations that are needing amateur radio help, at the same time trying to provide the logistical help for those hams that are already down there, those that are able to try and get something back up on the air. Putting it all together, answering to the served agencies like the Red Cross, the Salvation Army, FEMA, the Coast Guard, and all the other places that we had to send hams to so they could have communications. And all of this was new, and in the meantime, we've got another new thing happening. The media is looking to us for us to tell them what's going on. So it was a very interesting period of time. But also, it was probably amateur radio's brightest hours. Were there mistakes? Of course there were. An emergency situation is defined because there are mistakes, because there are things going wrong. If it all went wrong, it wouldn't be an emergency. But at the same time, amateur radio people all across the country, both those that actually went down to serve in the mud and those that stayed home, relayed messages all over the country, were receiving messages. It was the glory for amateur radio. We provided what was needed as best we could, and we did pretty good at it at the time, and people really stepped up to the plate. This is what amateur radio is for, not just advancing the art of radio technology, but if you look at what the FCC's got for why, what is the purpose of even having amateur radio, is to provide this pool of operators in case of a crisis. And we came through for them.
Our guest is Alan Pitts. We're speaking with him right now. He's W1AGP, and he's the ARRL Media and Public Relations Manager, and we're talking about Hurricane Katrina and some of the things that took place there. Well, you know, I don't think the general public. I have a cousin who is the head of Homeland Security here in Tennessee for one of the counties, and he told me, he said, the general public, and even for the most part, some of the folks that work in law enforcement are not necessarily in tune with how vulnerable their communication systems are.
Well, their communications work wonderfully, 99.9% of the time, no question. And when we talk about things, we want to make sure that we're not saying that other people's communication systems are no good or anything along those lines. They're good, and they're being developed even greater. But what we have found is when something major happens, two things can go wrong on the side. The first is these communication systems, because they are so good, they are also very complex, and they can be hurt or destroyed or screwed up in some way. The second part is they can be overwhelmed. They're designed to deal with normal situations and maybe a minor emergency. But when you have something overwhelming and you have literally thousands of people reaching for a cell phone all at the same time, things get overloaded, systems get jammed. You have to have some way of prioritizing communication, or in a sense almost like a backdoor route to make sure that the true emergency messages get through, even if there are no cell phones, even if the regular phone lines are jammed solid, even if your trunk lines, well, maybe they can carry 10 conversations at the same time, but you now have 200 officers all trying to talk at the same time. When these things get overloaded, you need something else.
Well, of course, when you have a disaster, you have not just the overload, but then sometimes you also have damage to the system. So either part of the system can be damaged, which means that it's only at half capacity, quarter capacity.
Well, we have this here. In Connecticut, they've got a very good system that works for the police and the emergency responders. It's wonderful. It's an ultra-high-frequency system, and no problem. Until we had an ice storm. And all of a sudden you realize that, radio waves that are way up in the gigahertz range have a real hard time going through 6 inches of ice. Nobody thought of that. And it's not that they're wrong or it's a bad system. It's a great system. Nobody just happened to think of or expect an ice storm like we had a couple of years ago.
Well, I watched a good snowstorm in Middle Tennessee completely take out cell phone service, and it wasn't there was anything wrong with the cell phone service. No. It was everyone was trying to use it at the same time, and it just died. It wouldn't work, period. But you have a disaster, you have a major thing that goes on, and you have normal lines of communication out for whatever reason it is, and you have long distance even communication, telephones overloaded and all that. But now you have this guy who can go out in the middle of a cornfield with a small generator and an antenna system and can talk to a town 500, 1,000 miles away and carry on very reliably under the most adverse conditions.
Well, what you're getting into is where I think we need to stop for a second and explain what's the difference to your listeners. The difference between amateur radio and other forms of communication is that within amateur radio, each and every operator is a complete independent transmitting and receiving unit. Each operator has the capability to send and receive messages without other infrastructure, such as cell towers, such as telephone switchboards, and all these other intermediate things. Ham radio can talk from one ham right through the airwaves to another ham around the block, around the corner, around the country. This cannot be done with a cell phone. If you have your cell phone, you say, oh, I can call my Uncle Harry. Yeah, but you can only call him if you have the cell tower and all that other intermediate equipment to get to Uncle Harry. You can be standing right next to Uncle Harry with your cell phone, and if that intermediate is not there, you can't make Harry's phone ring. The difference with hams, and I use the analogy, hams at an emergency are like ants at a picnic. Each one is independent. They're coordinated. The target's the chocolate cake. But each one can function totally independently. And even if you knock out a quarter of them, half of them, almost all of them, guess what? The ants are going to get to the cake. Same thing with hams. They will get a message through. They will set up a network for communication, and the emergency messages can get through because each one is totally independent. And it doesn't actually take a generator. Give me a battery and one of my radios, and I'm good to go any place in the world.
Well, let me ask a question here. I'd like for you to give me just a couple of stories that folks could relate to. And once again, our guest is Alan Pitts. We're talking with the ARRL Media and Public Relations Manager. And, of course, if you don't know what the ARRL is, that stands for American Radio Relay League. And it is the national organization of amateur and ham radio operators. Tell me a couple of stories about Katrina, something that that stands out in your mind. People love to hear these kind of things, and I know there's probably you probably have a hundred of them, but...
I'll give you a good one, and because that happened up here in Connecticut. One of the interesting phenomena, we were talking about the intermediate structure needed, one of the strange things that started happening during Katrina and people in New Orleans, they might be on a rooftop. Now, sometimes the cell phones, some of the cell towers were able to send messages a long ways away but could not even send them down the street. Because what happened is the signal would go from your cell phone to the cell tower and could get relayed long distance through the cell frequencies, but could not go onto a wire because the wire didn't exist anymore. So there were a lot of cell phone calls people were making from rooftops where they were flooded and had taken refuge that were being done. They were dialing randomly, hoping somewhere somebody at the other end would answer. And one such call was done by a lady who was on a rooftop with her family. And by pure just luck of the draw, she happened to get and call a lady in Virginia. Didn't know her. The lady in Virginia wasn't sure exactly all of what to do. But she knew the hams had something to do with this, but she couldn't think of any hams. So she, in turn, called the one person that she did know who had something to do, at least with amateur radio, and that was the section manager here for Connecticut, a lady named Betsy Doan. Betsy, when she gets the call, as soon as she figured out, no, this is real, Betsy knows exactly what to do, because not only is she a section manager, but she's also very well versed in emergency communications. And Betsy turned around. Betsy gets on her radio up here in Connecticut, relays it down to Texas. Texas, in turn, relays the message on in to the New Orleans Emergency Operations Center, who handed off to the, I believe it was the Coast Guard at that particular point. I don't want to swear to that, but I think it was the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard went and ultimately picked the lady and her family off the roof. Now, what comes out of the whole thing is the lady on the rooftop calls and gets back in touch with the lady in Virginia to say thank you. The lady in Virginia feels real good, calls Betsy. And it absolutely made Betsy's year. I will add that Betsy is recently retired and blind. So a blind, retired lady in Connecticut helped save the lives of people trapped on a roof down in New Orleans. That's amazing. Amateur radio.
That's amazing. Well, you know...
you're right. There's a lot of... I could keep on going. Don't get me started.
Oh, I want to get you started.
They're neat stories.
What exactly now, for folks who maybe wouldn't understand, what would be the typical function of a ham operator that would go down into the area where the problems in the disaster was? What would be the typical kind of thing that this ham could do that would be unique and that would help out and would, and make history, I guess, is the best way to put
it. The first thing is never self-deploy. Don't just go on down there. You'll probably be somebody we have to rescue instead of being a help. Work with your Aries people. In any kind of a deployment like this, they will call people, they will get, let them know you're available, let them know what your capabilities are, let them know, do you have the ability, what license class are you, what do you have, maybe an RV, do you have a tent, depending on the situation. Getting that information into your area's leadership. They, in turn, will call you when they need you and will tell you where to go. Now, in the case of Katrina, most of the hams were being funneled through Montgomery, Alabama. The reason for that is it still had good communications that far north of the coast. And we were using a Super Kmart, or what was left of a Super Kmart, along with the Red Cross as the assembly area. People would come on in, check in, get checked out, make sure they have the equipment they needed, and would be assigned to go to a specific location and report to a specific person. Now, this could be one of the food truck canteen type of things that was bringing food around. It could be a Red Cross shelter. It could be an emergency operations center. It could be a firehouse. When they go there, they need to figure, they're going to be there for several days. And just, you know, this is not a 9-to-5 type job. Yeah, we will get them back up as much, but a lot of these people, they were the only ones there because there was so much devastation at the time. The more operators we've got, the more we're able to give people relief.
But what would be the... What would
we,
be the...
Not, we do not send people in areas of threat, though. I want to... This is not Rambo. We are not first responders. We're maybe second or third. But we do not put people at all into an area where there is still a dangerous situation. And that's understood. That's up to the police and the fire and the military people. That's not our job.
Well, what would be a typical scenario of a job for, let's say, that a ham were assigned in an area? In the area of Katrina, just as an example, what would be a very typical type operation that they would be involved? What would be they be involved?
Well, I'll give you Dave, K1DAV, a guy named Dave Hyatt, who was a friend of mine, who also came down through Montgomery while I was down there. Dave came on down. His first assignment was with a Red Cross shelter. He came to Montgomery and was assigned and went further on down to the coast, reported in at a Red Cross shelter where he was for approximately 2 days. He was providing communications from that shelter. It was all there was. Most of the time he was providing the reports back on in as to how many people they had, the needs that the shelter had for food and everything else, water, fresh water, good water for drinking and all was in rather short supply, a number of different things. And as different other groups would come on or be passing on through, they'd be checking in and letting other people know where they are. Okay, so he was there for a couple of days. To some extent, they did a little bit of what we call health and welfare traffic, which is advising families outside the area that, okay, you know, Aunt Polly is fine. You know, she's here with the kids. She's safe. There was so much going on that the health and welfare stuff, well, it's important to families realize that actually often is a low priority in emergency traffic. We've got to make sure people are safe first, then we'll talk about it later. Dave was then released from that situation and was going on to another one, supposedly another shelter, but surprisingly when he got there, somewhere something had gotten screwed up. He was where the GPS told him he's supposed to be, but there was nothing there, just rubble, and was unable to find the shelter. Okay, so he's working his way back again. The shelter was not there, had been destroyed. Well, we found out later why they wanted him there, because nobody had heard from them. Well, it wasn't even there. On his way back, he happens to stop off at a firehouse because there was no gasoline supplies, and he had the card and all, which said, yeah, this is one of the guys that can get some gasoline or would be allowed to get gasoline. When he stopped at the firehouse, he ran into a situation where they had not had supplies or anything else in several days and were running real short on everything, including food and drinking water. And he just stayed there at the firehouse, checked in, let everybody know where he was, and he worked with the chief of police and the fire chief out of that firehouse for that town, and I wish I could remember the name of the town right now. But he stayed there, and he was their telephone system, their voice, their communications for several more days until he was relieved for that entire town.
So it's just amazing all the different hats and roles and I guess I'm going to say gaps that the amateur radio operator can fill in on in an emergency like this.
Hams are, if nothing else, they're the ultimate MacGyvers. We'll figure out a way to do something. One way or another, hams make it happen.
Oh my.
We've got a tradition of it. We're proud of it. It may not be pretty, but we'll make it happen.
My younger son is a chief engineer for the Dave Ramsey Show out of Nashville, and he's KG4WXX. And working in the studio, they all refer to him as MacGyver because of that particular trait,
mm-hmm.
being able to make something work that probably shouldn't. Alan Pitts.
Well, let me throw a one-liner you can hang on to. And this comes from Dave Sumner, K1ZZ. He said, "The professionals built the Titanic. Amateurs built the Ark."
Alan Pitts is a fellow we're talking through, or two, I should say, W1AGP, the ARRL Media and Public Relations Manager. A lot of changes going on in ham radio right now.
Oh, yes.
Are you able to talk about any of that? For example...
Just on Friday... let's see, it would be Friday the 15th. The FCC, interestingly enough, at the very end of the business day, the FCC put up a press release announcing that they were going to be dropping the Morse code testing for amateur radio licenses. Now, there had not been testing required for the entry-level technician class license, but there had been Morse code requirements for anyone to get the general or the extra class license. And it was interesting that it came up very late Friday, and all there was the press release. And first reaction was, is this real? And the answer is, yes, it was. Approximately 1 o'clock our time here on December 19th, we got the actual documents, the Federal Communications Commission's report and order, relating to this, to be, and we know exactly where they're going. But one of the things that is very new is that they will be dropping the Morse code requirements to get your license. Interesting part as to what happens on this. This is not unexpected. A number of other countries have dropped those requirements, and once it was no longer required internationally, we all expected that the FCC would do so. The ARRL wanted the requirement to learn Morse code to be kept, at least for the highest class license. But the FCC, as expected, said, no, we're going to drop all the Morse code. Now, watching human behavior, which is always a very interesting thing to do, in the other countries that already had dropped Morse code, such as England, Australia, Canada, a number of the European countries, when they dropped learning the da-da-da-da-da-da of Morse code, code use increased. Hams are interesting. We're almost counter-dependent type people. Once the code was no longer required to get your license, people wanted to learn it. And it's, well, it may not be required anymore, it is still very much being used. So that spread is that first was pretty much limited to what we call 50 megahertz and up, the VHF, UHF. For your listeners, we can say, for mostly, that's line-of-sight type of communications. And what has happened is the technician class license now will be getting, when this thing goes into effect, the technician class licensees will be getting the same kind of high-frequency privileges that used to be for the novice class. What this means is that even with the entry-level technician class license, you'll be allowed to work on those frequencies, certain parts of them, which give you worldwide communications capabilities. So this is something the FCC agreed with the ARRL. The ARRL championed this idea. Allow these entry-level people, let them get their feet wet. They're not going to have everything in the HF stuff, the worldwide communications capabilities, but at least let them have something. And the FCC agreed with it, and this is good. And so we're looking forward to this. It'll be nice to see a lot of the technician class people find out firsthand what it's like to talk with. And to me, it's wonderful. I can sit in my room at home, and I'm talking with Italy, and I'm talking with Japan and a number of other places. That's magical. That's magical. And once you get your feet wet in this and get a taste of this, you want to go on. You want to learn more. You want to get those higher class licenses. You want to become better and better at being a true ham. And I think that's going to be exciting. I think we got a very interesting year coming up. And it's a new era, literally, in amateur radio, where Morse code is no longer required. And what I think is going to happen, and has been the experience in other countries, where they drop the code and let the new people have a taste, a little bit, of what it's like to be able to do their own worldwide communications, I think we're going to have some fun.
Well, I think the beauty of the code, especially when I was growing up, if you could build a one tube CW transmitter so easily, just out of a box of parts, literally, and have it on the air, and the simplicity of that. Now, of course, you can build a CW transmitter out of a couple of ICs and some.
Yeah,
you know, it's basically the same thing, but it gives people I think you're right. I think there will be a certain amount of nostalgia. There'll be an attraction to the code, as opposed to the dread of the code. You know, and I think that there's something to be said for that.
Yeah, the FCC has stated, you know, why are we requiring testing on one type of communication as opposed to, let's say, digital HF radio, or what we call PSK for your listeners. It's a thing that uses computers and sends a warbly kind of signal, or so many other different types, or let's say television signals, which hams also use. You know, why do we have testing just on this one type? What they would really rather people do is get involved and start learning on hands-on stuff. And I'm looking for the actual quote here that the FCC put in their report and order. We believe these changes will encourage individuals who are interested in communications technology or who are able to contribute to the advancement of the radio art to become amateur radio operators, and that they will eliminate a requirement that may discourage amateur service licensees from advancing their skills in the communication and technical phases of amateur radio. That's a quote straight out of the report and order that just came out.
Well, you know, times change, and modes of mm-hmm. operation change. I remember when I first got a novice license, it was, it was, like you said, it was like magic. You know, you put the dipole up in the backyard. You have I think my first was an Amico CW transmitter or something like that. And I remember sitting there, I was just taken away by collecting all these QSL cards from just across the country. People sent, you know, and it was slow CW. It was just fun, though. I mean, I couldn't wait to come home from school to fire up the ham rig and get on and get me three or four more cards tonight, you know, that type of thing. And
I can look out in my backyard to do wire in a tray, and my wife may say, well, that's a fairly big wire. Well, it's okay, it's about 40 feet long, but it's a wire in a tray. If your listeners have had the enjoyment of flying coast to coast or flying long distance in an airliner, and you look out the airliner windows and you watch the country roll by for hours on end, and it keeps going, and you're seeing so much area, you're watching the land change, and all of a sudden it clicks. Wait a second. That little wire back home in my tree, I would not even be able to see it, you know, from half the site. That tiny little wire is able to send my words from way back there to way over there. Wow.
And the path following the following a line not too dissimilar from the flight you're taking in the airplane.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really when you're flying, you understand just, they could talk about it's getting to be a small world, but you fly for a while, and that's a big lot of land and country down there. And that's not even international. And that little wire in my back tree, in a lot, on a house that you can't even see from that airplane. can get that message all the way over to the other side of the country where it will be received and understood, that's magic.
Well, and that's
that's magic. I don't care. I understand the physics. That's magic.
And that's the basis of the broadcast that we're on right this very second. You know, what I want to do now, and once again, I announce this frequently because folks that just tune in, they'll say, who is he talking to? I'm talking to Alan Pitts. And Alan is the ARRL, Media and Public Relations Manager for the American Radio Relay League. And something really, really magical and extremely special is going on within the next few days.
Yep.
And that is the 100-year anniversary of the first voice transmission over radio.
Well, it's the first actual broadcast that we know of.
Well, yeah, it wouldn't be the first.
Let me qualify it a little bit.
Wouldn't be the first transmission because there was actually a couple of transmissions before that, but the first broadcast.
Right. There's a bit of an argument as to whether Reginald Fessenden or Marconi might have made the first actual just voice transmission as such in some way. Maybe yes, maybe no. We don't know. They're both working on it at the same time. However, one of the things we do know for sure is that one of Reginald Fessenden was working in Brant Rock, Massachusetts at the time. And his job was to use radio to send Morse code weather reports to the ships at sea that were what became the Chiquita Banana Company. And one of his engineers was working with Fessenden, and they were playing around on their spare time, trying to come up and work with developing some kind of voice communications. And lo and behold, he gets a letter from over in Macrahanish, Scotland. And in Scotland, they heard the voice of his engineer, a guy named Stein. And, okay, they did something right, and they didn't even know what it was. Well, Fessenden then started playing around again, and he thought he had it pretty well figured out. And his plan was to formally make a message from Brant Rock, Massachusetts, across the Atlantic to the sister station over there in Scotland. A voice message. And he's getting all ready for this, but unfortunately, it's winter, and a storm came up, and it blew down the towers over there in Scotland. So, scratch that. Well, we were talking about hams being the ultimate MacGyvers and always having a plan B. So Fessenden then decided, wait a second, I think this is going to work. I'm going to go to plan B. Instead of transmitting to Macrahanish, Scotland, he decided that he's going to come up when he's supposed to be doing the weather report, 9 o'clock Christmas Eve, and he's going to talk with the ships at sea. So up and down the East Coast, the United Fruit Company people, they're waiting for their weather report Christmas Eve, and instead, up comes Fessenden, and there's a voice coming out of that radio instead of the da-da-da-da-da-da of Morse code. A voice comes up and says hello, wishes them a Merry Christmas, announces who he is and what's going on. He plays some music on his violin. His wife was supposed to be reading the Gospel of Luke Christmas story, but we have the first documented case of mic fright. She locked up entirely. The secretary wasn't much better. So, boy, is this modern stuff. When you got dead air, what do they do at a station? They try to cover it with recorded music. So what did Fessenden do? He grabbed the Edison cylinder Victrola and starts playing Largo recorded music on the phonograph and wraps up the record. This was the first broadcast that was ever done. It was a voice broadcast on Christmas Eve, 1906. Now, he did a second one. When he found out it all worked, he did a second one on New Year's Eve. However, we're celebrating what happened, because that broadcast that happened in 1906 The fact that it could be done sent literally hundreds of amateur tinkerers, experimenters, into their basements and into their garages to try and start playing with this newfangled thing called radio to see what could happen, what they might make do with this. The idea of being able to talk to people over the radio was exciting and was new to them. And that is what really triggered and kicked over a lot of what we now know as the whole radio industry, broadcast industry, amateur radio, and everything else developed out of that. And in the past 100 years, obviously, radio has developed from a whole lot better than that early squawky transmission that Fessenden did. And the hams have been there all the way along. The development of so many of the technologies that have improved radio communication were developed or improved upon or co-improved by the amateur radio people that we're very proud of this. I mean, single sideband, FM, hams had mobile phones long before your cell phone was even thought of. And they're now talking about, oh, well, we're going to have digital. Well, guess what? We've been playing with digital radio communications for years. Hams have their own satellites. We've been bouncing signals off the moon. We've got all kinds of things. Yeah, we still play with Morse code. It's kind of like auto collectors. You know, some people like Lamborghinis and some people like the old Ford Model Ts, but they're all automobile collectors. Hams are like that. Everybody likes different parts and different things, and the hobby is big enough for everybody. But the nice part is we can celebrate 100 years because the world changed. When you start putting voices on the airwaves, anybody, even in the smallest hamlet, even in the most backwards place in the world, they don't have to understand Morse code. They don't need anything except, in this case, many times it was nothing more than a piece of wire or a radio crystal and some kind of headphones. But they could hear and get the news, the ideas, the information, the culture of the world opened up to them. And that started 100 years ago this season, and we're having a major celebration on the 29th and 30th talking about 100 years of voice and the role that ham radio has had in the development of wireless communications.
Oh, there's a website you might want to talk a little bit.
www.helloradio.org.
Now, there's a dash in between there. So
you don't have to have the dash.
Really? Okay. Well, if you do the helloradio.com, it has to have a dash in there because I made the mistake of going the other route.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's why I put the .com for people that mistype things.
That was for me because I put it in there. But tell us a little bit about the website. Now, but let's just think about this for a minute. Let's just suppose that you are on board ship out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, and every night you went for your weather report, and it came in CW, series of dots and dashes, and you're busy copying down the weather report, and 9 o'clock rolls around on Christmas Eve, and all of a sudden there's a voice going CQ, CQ, and then starts in telling you who he is and all that. I mean, can you imagine what that was like for the operator on the receive end to all of a sudden be hearing a voice, something he had never heard come through his receiver before?
It would be the equivalent of you sitting there watching your 42-inch plasma high-definition television and literally one of the characters step off the screen into your living room.
That's exactly what it would be like.
I mean, it's the same thing. The jaw drops completely, and it's, duh, what?
Then I think
it changed the world. It just literally, I don't think they understood just how much it really did change the world, because nobody made a big deal of it at the time. But as it's come, we've come to recognize how much the world was changed. Once you put voice out there, and that's the key, the human voice carries many, many things besides just what you say. It's not just your words. It's also your inflection, your tone of voice. There's what we call the voice song. And many people actually believe that the voice song predates actual regular speech. because just by humming, I can convey to you a whole lot of information. And if you can see me between my face and my humming, you get even more information. But even if you can't see me, just the tone, the voice, the pitch, the inflection, whether the end of the sentence rises or falls, tells you just as much, if not more sometimes, than what my actual choice of words might be.
Well, according to what I've read, and this is off the website, the ARRL website, helloradio.org, and in some other places, including, I think, there was a broadcast journal that just came in that's got the story in it as well. He had played a selection off of the Victrola, and that was Handel's Largo.
Correct.
Then he followed that up by playing a violin solo of himself. But I guess evidently he must have been a violinist, and he played O Holy Night on the violin.
And that's what I'm reading.
And then,
I hope he was a good violinist.
And then, of course, it talked about the fact that they were going to read passages from the Bible in regards to the Christmas story. You know,
correct.
And I thought, what a marvelous first broadcast to have ever aired on radio.
Well, you know, it's given the night, everybody, and when you're very lonely, you're out at a ship at sea, it's Christmas Eve, you're going to shock people bad enough as it is. But might as well at least give them something they're not terrified of.
I just, you know, it just seems so unique. And then to think about what has come along since then as a result of it. And I think it's really almost amusing that in the midst of a broadcast, he grabs a phonograph. Is that not a natural?
Yeah, to cover the dead air. How many times have you still seen that?
Well, I mean, every radio station in the country, when it first went on the air, we would have been out of business if it hadn't have been for turntables, you know?
I mean, the more things change, the more they stay the same sometimes. But isn't it interesting? 100 years ago, radio was the brand new, exciting technology. And here we are 100 years later. Yeah, we're talking digital now. Yeah, we're talking higher frequencies. Yeah, we're talking, you know, different. And I turn on my television and I look at, okay, what's the hot new thing? Well, we, you know, this WII play stick thing that interacts. Wireless technology. 100 years later, it's still the most exciting technology.
Wireless technology. As a friend of mine used to say when he would come on the radio, he would always say, "Welcome to the wireless."
And, yep. You know, it is magical. It truly is. Nobody quite has still figured out how it does what it does, but
well, there's certain moments.
It is magical.
There's certain moments, too. I can remember as a child visiting with a ham radio operator in Dearborn, Michigan. It was the first amateur station I'd ever seen. And I'm going to guess the year was probably 1955. And this gentleman had a, I don't know, my years may be off, but I remember till the day I die, he had a Hallicrafters SX-101 and a Heathkit Marauder exciter for single sideband. And for those of you that are out there, you probably remember these things. And he had a three-element 20-meter beam and a homebrew linear amplifier of a pair of 813s. For all of our listeners, This is geek talk, okay?
But we're nice geeks.
Yeah, but he pointed the antenna and threw out a CQ, and a voice came back from Denver, Colorado, and he carried on a conversation with this guy, and I sat there. I have no idea how. I was very young. We were just a kid. And it just totally, completely mesmerized me that he could just sit there and through the magic of radio, directly, without wires or anything, talk to this guy in Denver, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, I can remember being at a shortwave radio facility and playing a song on the air while a caller had called in from the tip of South Africa. And holding the telephone up to his radio, I could hear the song that I was playing. You know, there's certain moments, things like that happen, that actually will give you a chill, you know, and you realize just exactly how magic this medium is. And, you know, and you also, from working in the radio business and in doing a lot of engineering work, I don't know how many times I've stood out beside a radio tower after, you know, getting something, especially with an AM station, firing it all back up and looking up at this thing and saying, you know, we really don't know what it is that's leaving this tower that travels so far.
That's what I say. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand the physics and all, but nobody really does. It's magic.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking with you, sir. And is there any parting comments, anything that you'd like to say or any information you'd like to pass along?
Well, if we have anyone that is listening that has thought about getting their amateur radio license, I really encourage you to go to www.helloradio.org, O-R-G. That's www.helloradio.org, O-R-G. There's a lot of help there. Yes, amateur radio is different in the sense that you have to earn a license. Yes, you will have to study. Most people, with 1 week of honest study, not messing around, but real study, 1 week of study, they take the initial test on the weekend, they can pass that initial testing. It's better if you go to a class. There's also video products and everything else. The idea is get your license. Find out what it's like. It's not that expensive to get into. Getting your license, about $40-$50 maybe. Getting your first radio and getting on the air, about $200 maybe. Used equipment you can probably find even cheaper. Get on the air. Find out about this. It's a great hobby. It's a service to your community. We've talked about how these people, the hams, can turn around and literally be lifesavers at times. And it's a whole lot of fun. So if you're thinking about it, this is the time to do it. And I would really encourage you to take a good look at it.
Alan Pitts has been our guest, W1AGP, the ARRL Media and Public Relations Manager. Sir, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us.
You're very, very welcome. I'm pleased to be here. We'll do it again.
Okay, and 73s.
73.